is a circle.
The sun is a circle.
The moon is a circle.
The moon is a circle.
The earth is a circle.
The earth is a circle.
The drum is a circle.
The drum is a circle.
We are a circle within a circle.
We are a circle within a circle.
Thank you. This creates a container for the teachings. And before we get too far into the teachings, I would like to take a little bit of time to do some focused shamatha meditation on the world and all of the places where there is strife, all of the people who are suffering in so many different types of ways. And I'd just like to take a moment to focus inward, settle in, watching your breath, moving in, moving out. And as that inner space opens up, just making a wish for any group of people or any person or any situation that's happening anywhere on the planet, any part of nature, any animals, anyone who is suffering, just bringing your wishes for their well-being into this space. Offering loving kindness. And then coming back to your breath. Watching it move in and out. And then following your breath back out into the room. And as you do, just feeling the surface under you again. And coming back fully into the room when you're ready.
Hi, Isa. Thank you for the practice. Sorry, just to interrupt. We've got a few messages from people saying that they're having a hard time hearing. I hear really well, but there might be an issue with your mic on some people's machines. So I don't know if there's a possibility to turn your mic up.
We just adjusted it.
Okay, great.
Is it better now?
Maybe people can tell us, because for me, it's been good the whole time. So anyone in the chat who said that they were having issues hearing, please can you let us know if it's better now?
So I'm just talking, so you can measure it. Is it okay?
I would recommend
Still low.
putting earphones on if they're not
Yeah.
listening with earphones,
Yeah.
because different computers have different
Yeah.
quality audio things.
Yeah. Yeah, if you have headphones, that does help. All right. So yeah. Someone says Laura's mic is picking up fine. Isis is soft.
Issa seems to have a
Try this.
microphone that is a few feet away from her.
Try this
So
now,
I'm
Issa.
hearing that.
Thank you. Issa, would you try that?
Okay, how is this now? Is this better? Is this better?
Should be better.
This should be better.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Great.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you
Thank
for
you
your
for all your
help.
help.
Thanks very
Okay.
much, everyone.
Okay. All right.
It takes a village.
It does take a village. So I really appreciate your input. Thank you. So we are here today to talk about the path of the Bodhisattva, and in particular, the psychology of the Bodhisattva. And I'd like to spend a little bit of time talking about what a Bodhisattva is and the context in which it arises. And I know some of you may be well acquainted with this part of the teaching, but I feel we must honor the roots of the origins of the concept of the Bodhisattva. And of course, in Buddhist practice, you have many w turning of the wheels of the Dharma, many schools of practice, many different views on the path to enlightenment, and many different ideas about the best use of the enlightened state. And if you could say that, I mean, it's a very un-Buddhist idea to use the enlightened state, but there is, in terms of the schools that are at present here today in the conversation, the Theravadin school of Buddhism and the Mahayana school of Buddhism offer a counterpoint to the understanding about the path toward a more enlightened state, and what one does in terms of attaining that enlightened state. Much of the teaching, all of the teachings toward that enlightened state are common to both schools, of course. If you have taking refuge in the three jewels, you have the Four Noble Truths, you have the Eightfold Path, you have fundamental teachings that are common to both schools, and offer a pathway toward a more enlightened state of being. And the goal, of course, being, if again, very un-Buddhist idea to have a goal, but the idea, of course, is to kind of open into a more expanded way of being and understanding, with greater insight and understanding about the nature of oneself and the nature of reality. And in the Theravadin schools of Buddhism, once one has attained that a certain level of awareness and, ideally enlightenment, although this is an elusive idea, no matter what school you're in, the idea is to stay there in that enlightened state, and to cultivate that enlightened state more deeply. And in the Mahayana schools of Buddhism, after attaining a certain level of awareness, a more enlightened state, the idea is to then return to the world of suffering, the realm of samsara, the place where suffering occurs due to misunderstandings about the nature of reality, the nature of oneself, and all of the architecture of samsara is well described, of course, in the Four Noble Truths. and to return to this realm where people are still suffering with misunderstanding about, the nature of the self, the way that they work with their attachments and their aversions to try to consolidate a sense of self, and the misunderstanding about the nature of the solidity of the self that all of that activity emerges out of. This is where the bodhisattvas, having liberated themselves from that place, then return to help others. So I'd like to open with a couple of readings about this sort of the motivating impulse of a bodhisattva returning to the realm of suffering. I'm going to introduce the idea of a bodhisattva in training very shortly because I think it really matches the place where many of us are as we are striving to help others and help ourselves, help others. But I'd like to open, of course, with His Holiness's words from The Meaning of Life, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, the 14th Dalai Lama. The nature of an altruistic mind is precious. It is indeed amazing that the human mind can develop such an attitude, for one forgets oneself and considers every other being to be as dear as oneself. This is truly marvelous. If someone shows us warm feeling, we feel very happy, and it is the same when we show other people sincere concern. I think that with such an attitude, all of cyclic existence would be like nirvana. This is the real source of happiness, not only in the long run, but even today. If even the slightest experience of this develops, it will help by bestowing peace of mind and inner strength. It attracts the best of all experiences and provides the best ground for active participation in society. It serves not only as a teacher, but also as a best friend and protector. It is truly good. So this is the altruistic mind that the intention to become a bodhisattva rises out of or is informed by. And I'd like to read a few more words along these lines from Infinite Life by Robert Thurman. I always appreciate what Bob has to say about the bodhisattva. He says, once you have adopted an attitude of infinite interconnectedness, you naturally want to liberate not just yourself, but all beings from suffering. The Buddha calls this the conception of the spirit of enlightenment. It is the soul of the bodhisattva, the person who dedicates him or herself in helping all beings achieve total happiness. When you open to the inevitability of your infinite interconnectedness with other sensitive beings, you develop compassion. You learn to feel empathy for them, to love them, to want their happiness. You want to keep them from suffering, and you do so just as if they were a part of you. You don't think that your behavior makes you special. You don't congratulate yourself for helping others, just as you wouldn't congratulate yourself for healing your own leg when you've hurt it. It is natural for you to love your leg because it is one with you, and so it is natural for you to love others. You would certainly never harm another being. As the great Buddhist adept Shantideva, the 8th century Indian sage, wrote, "How wonderful will it be when all beings experience each other as limbs on the one body of life." In this way, this notion of universal responsibility is just a commonsensical attitude, as commonsensical as the acceptance of infinite life. We are merely adding the lives of others to our own, recognizing our inevitable interconnection. So appreciate these words of wisdom from these wonderful teachers that we're so lucky to be on the planet with. How wonderful, what good fortune we have to be born on the planet at the same time that His Holiness is here, and where we have Bob exhorting us toward greater liberation. And just letting those words land, and thinking about the path of the Bodhisattva, and thinking about the fact that I would imagine that most of the people here are thinking about others, are trying to think about others. You don't find yourself in a lecture about the path of the Bodhisattva without having had some idea about what it is to serve others and what it means to offer your life toward that pursuit. And from a Buddhist perspective, once you take the vow of the Bodhisattva, which we're going to be working with at length here today. It's reminding me I have to keep track of time, so that we have plenty of time for the meditation. What I'd like to do is just talk about how the Bodhisattva path, once you make this decision, that you actually return to the fundamental teachings of Buddhism in a new way. And I think that there's a deepening of understanding. I feel like the path of the Bodhisattva itself is a deepening, an opening, expanding path into the some of even the most basic Buddhist teachings. And I'd like to kind of demonstrate that right now as we revisit, for instance, the three jewels, taking refuge in the three jewels. So, of course, at the beginning of the path, when you take refuge away from the winds of samsara, you are taking refuge in the three jewels, which are the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And of course, in this way, you are taking refuge in the teacher, the Buddha, in the Dharma, the teachings, and the Sangha, the like-minded individuals who are also trying to take refuge out of all of the ways in which we generate our own suffering, and when we are leading an unexamined life. At the beginning of the path, the idea of refuge seems so far away. Like the idea that you could take yourself out of the suffering that you're finding yourself in. The idea that you could actually find a teaching and a teacher that might show you the way out of your unhappy circumstances is just a very big idea. And indeed, at the beginning of the path, taking refuge is it can be a struggle, because part of what you're doing as you are taking refuge is you are leaving behind some of your habits of forming reality that on one level seem quite pleasant, especially when you are steeped in samsara, being attached to a particular substance or being attached to a particular way of relating to people, or avoiding things that you think might harm you. I mean, they seem like, not a bad idea, But when you realize the way in which these attachments and these aversions kind of trap you into a sort of narrow way of knowing and understanding, you really do determine to take refuge away from the illusions of samsara. And when you return to the idea of refuge as a bodhisattva, the struggle of refuge is over. There's no two ways about it. There's There's nothing that is so attractive that would keep you in the realms of samsara. There's no temptation that would pull you away from your dedication to truly taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And the wisdom of refuge is seated squarely in one's own psychology, that it's central to one's psychology. And this creates a very different orientation to the world. The sort of the bright lights of samsara fade pretty deeply, pretty quickly, when that altruistic intention is strongly held, and that understanding of the interconnectedness of yourself and all beings is a fact. The psychological orientation is one where you are in refuge rather than samsara, that you are in a different place. You're not struggling to get to that different place. That's not to say that we don't all have karmic traces that might pull us back in, and then we do have to do a little bit of work to get out. But the psychological orientation is primarily one to refuge. I was wondering, Faith, if you wouldn't mind giving me a 5-minute cue, because I don't have an analog clock here. I meant to bring that. So if you could give me a 5-minute cue when we're need to move to the meditation, that would be really helpful.
Yeah, so we're probably, I would say 10 minutes from now. But I mean, it's
I was worried about
flexible.
that.
If you
I
need
was
a bit
worried
more
about
time,
that.
go for
I
it.
was feeling like I was running out of time. Okay, thank you. Okay. When we have this base of refuge as a psychological orientation, the Bodhisattva wades into samsara to help other beings. And I'm trying to remember the teaching where there's this description of a bodhisattva wading back into samsara as easily and as gracefully as a swan wades into a pond. There's just this total, graceful re-entry into samsara. And the idea there is that samsara is not somehow different from the enlightened state or nirvana. It's not like you are leaving this, jeweled land, and now you're returning to the places of difficulty in the world. Of course, you are returning to the places of difficulty in the world, but you don't see it as somehow very separate. You understand, you have attained a certain level of understanding where the duality of nirvana and samsara, or the enlightened state and the suffering state, are quite dualistic. There's so many teachings that on the path of developing the altruistic intention, there are so many teachings that help you understand that even at the heart of any samsaric emanation is the ground luminosity, which is the essence of an enlightened state of being. So the Bodhisattva enters, you're entering, from this place of refuge, you're entering into the realm of samsara as a swan enters the lake. I think, I know myself, I try to attain that grace. I try to every day, as I try to help in any way I can, I try to remember that view of the swan. And the relationship to samsara is fundamentally different from this perspective. And so you're not, as a bodhisattva, you're not scrambling to get away from it the way you are when you're trying to take refuge at the beginning. This is a state of being that you understand, that you are returning to, and that you are trying to bring all the skillful means and wisdom that you have to it. And in this way, the path of the Bodhisattva provides a deeper, more subtle path to realization, passing over the same ground that has been tread before, but attuned to more subtle phenomenon which generates suffering. And so, you know, the Buddha, the teacher, is there as you know, the famous analogy, is there as the doctor. The teachings are there as the medicine, and the Sangha is there as the nurses, and you're all participating in this movement toward health, this movement towards psychological health. And in terms of our relationship to the Four Noble Truths as Bodhisattvas, our psychological orientation is different there. There's unwavering vigilance to our own aversions, attachments, and ignorance. We're not trying to pretend that we're not attached to that thing over there. You know, we're, you know, if we find ourselves doing that, we quickly move to practice, right? We unhesitatingly resolve to banish any kind of attachment or aversion, or examine any misunderstanding that we may have. We are able, actually, as Bodhisattvas in training, to recognize the attachments, aversions, and misunderstandings in others, and bring compassion to the way in which they are creating their suffering, and you know, compassionate holding of that phenomenon, and whenever we have permission, to kind of point out with help how they might be creating their suffering. And so this is a you know, another orientation to some of the basic teachings of, in this case, the Four Noble Truths that a Bodhisattva has. Now, I'm just going to go a little bit into the meditation piece, because I really do want to bring home this idea of the Bodhisattva in training. Because clearly, I mean, I don't know about you, but I've been working for a long time. I've been a practicing Buddhist for, you know, the better part of my life. And I cannot in any way say that I've attained any kind of enlightenment that would somehow differentiate me from anyone else. But I do have a perspective of understanding my life and helping other people understand, people who come to study with me. And, you know, I wouldn't necessarily go out on the street and, you know, pass out leaflets about this. But if someone asks me, you know, I really understand that everything that is coming up, you know, for me as I try to help other people, any kind of attachments I have to the relief of suffering of other people, or any aversions that I have to being able to be present with the level of suffering that someone has, is a place to practice. And thank you. And I think that this is actually one of the ways in which you can recognize a Bodhisattva in training, is someone who is trying to understand their relationship to their own suffering from this newer perspective that we've discussed, and who are trying to help other people with their, however that might be, with their level of suffering. They may be, you know, a teacher, they may be a parent, they may be a boss, they may be, you know, an eco-activist, they may be a politician who is truly trying to help the world, right? And yet finding that they have to examine their own relationship to suffering to a new extent, and that they have to see how their ideas about trying to relieve suffering in others may be a function of a miscue in terms of understanding the nature of suffering. And then they set upon or how to relieve suffering. And This is where I spend a lot of time, right, in this place of working with people who have tried so hard to do their best to help, and they've had the wisdom to see that there was work to be done in relieving suffering, but they had not developed the skillful means yet to truly understand what heals and what doesn't heal. And I think that this is a learning curve that we all walk in our life. I don't think any of us get to the end of this in this lifetime. I mean, maybe we will. It would be wonderful if we did. But I think that understanding the path as just the altruistic intention as an ignition to a path of deeper understanding of the basic teachings on a more subtle level, so that we can use the effort to understand what relieves suffering, what creates suffering, what relieves suffering, and how, what our proper relationship is to suffering, is itself a deepening. I would even say it is a turn of the wheel of the Dharma that we can all walk and understand and allow the path to teach us, even as we are trying to help others relieve their suffering. So, walking this path, we take a certain vow. We take the vow of the Bodhisattva in our own ways. We may not articulate it exactly the way that it has been articulated by Shantideva, who, in his famous book, The Bodhisattva's Way of Life, brings to life a very beautiful vow that is very beautifully translated by Robert Thurman in his book, Essential Tibetan Buddhism. And I do have to say, I really just take a moment to, of course, Bob is a good friend of mine. We teach together. And he has written some really amazing, amazing words. And one thing that I offer you is this book, The Essential Tibetan Buddhism. It's really, it brings together in an organized way many of the most important texts, and gives you a fundamental place to grab onto some of the fundamental texts of Mahayana Buddhism in particular. And I know, because it's so hard to wade through it all. There's so much. There's so much wisdom. But I found this book to be a wonderful handbook, and I do appreciate Bob as a translator. So I'd like to do a meditation based on this vow. So let's go ahead and get settled. Feeling your feet on the floor, your hands on your lap. Your spine is straight. And just finding your breath. Feeling the surface under you and watching your breath move in and watching your breath move out. And just beginning to notice the way in which your breath is like a bridge between your outer world and your inner world. And just following your breath into your inner world, into that place where everything that you've ever known or felt or sensed or dreamed or imagined is recorded. And just allowing yourself to focus here in this place where your intention to be of service, to help others, to relieve your own suffering and to relieve the suffering of others arises. And just staying focused here on this intention that arises, this altruistic intention that arises within you. And focus on your willingness and your capacity to live this set of teachings. May I be the doctor and the medicine. And may I be the nurse for all the sick beings in the world until everyone is healed. May a rain of food and drink descend to clear away the pain of thirst and hunger. And during the eon of famine, may I turn myself into food and drink. May I become an inexhaustible treasure for those who are poor and destitute. May I turn into all things they could need. And may these be placed close beside them. By giving up all, sorrow is transcended, and my mind will realize the sorrowless state. It is best that I now give to all beings in the same way as I shall at death. If in those who encounter me a faithful or angry thought arises, may that eternally become the source for fulfilling all their wishes. May all those who say bad things to me or cause me any harm, and those who mock and insult me, have the good fortune to fully awaken. May I be a protector for those without one, a guide for travelers on the way. May I be a bridge, a boat, and a ship for all who wish to cross the water. May I be an island for those who seek one, and a lamp for those desiring light. And may I be a bed for all who wish to rest. May I be a wishing jewel, a magic vase, powerful mantras, and great medicine. May I become a wish-fulfilling tree and a cow of plenty for the world, just like space and all the great elements such as earth. May I always support the life of all the boundless creatures. And until they pass away from pain, may I also be the source of life for all the realms of varied beings that reach unto the ends of space. Just as the previous lords of bliss conceived the enlightenment spirit, and just as they successively lived by the bodhisattva practices, likewise, for the sake of that all that lives, do I conceive the spirit of enlightenment. And likewise, shall I too successively follow the practices in order to fully increase it from now on, the intelligent who have vividly taken the spirit of enlightenment in this way should ever extol it in the following manner. Today, my life has borne fruit. Having well obtained this human existence, I've been born in the family of Buddha, and now I am one of Buddha's children. Thus, whatever actions I do from now on must be in accordance with the family tradition. Never shall I do anything to disgrace this holy, faultless family. And just like a blind man discovering a jewel in a heap of trash, likewise, by some coincidence, I have found the enlightenment spirit within me. It is the supreme elixir that overcomes the Lord of Death. It is the inexhaustible treasure that eliminates all poverty in the world. It is the supreme medicine that cures the world's disease. It is the evergreen tree that shelters all beings wandering tired on the roads of life. It is the universal bridge that frees being from wretched lives. It is the rising moon of the mind that dispels the torment of addictions. It is the great sun that burns away the misty ignorance of the world. It is the quintessential butter from the churning of the milk of the Dharma. For all guests traveling the path of life, who wish to experience this true happiness, this spirit will satisfy them with joy and exalt them in the highest bliss. Today, in the presence of all the saviors, I invite the world to be my guests at the feast of temporal and ultimate bliss. May gods, titans, and all be joyful. And just allowing yourself to reflect on these words. Just noting your response. To this path. How fully do you find yourself embracing it? And just allowing yourself to be wherever you are in terms of that embrace. There's no right way or no wrong way. Allowing yourself to be where you are. In terms of your willingness or your capacity to live this vow. And then when you're ready, just returning to your breath. Watching your breath move in. And watching your breath move out. When you're ready, just beginning to follow your breath on your exhale back out into the room. Feeling the surface under you. And whenever you're ready, just stretching a bit, opening your eyes. Maybe just taking a few minutes to write down a few notes. Just reflect on your experience. So just knowing that we're going to take some time to talk about our experience, I would be very interested to hear what people's thoughts are about engaging with the vow and ideas that you have or questions that you have around this idea that we kind of entered into the meditation with of developing the skillful means needed and developing the wisdom needed in order to be able to fully fulfill one's altruistic intention and of wanting to receive not only relief of suffering for oneself, but also to relieve suffering for others. Just before we head into the questions and answers, I have a few kind of announcements. First of all, I'd like to once again thank Sangha Live for doing all that you do to really hold down this major global Sangha and invite all the wonderful teachers that you invite. And I feel very honored to be invited. And thank you again for that. And I exhort everyone to support Sangha Live and their efforts by donating what you can to support their work. And just so you know that the work that you, the portion that I'm receiving for this will go to our scholarship fund here at the Sacred Stream to support people who would like to study the Dharma specifically in the Applied Buddhist Psychology program. And I also wanted to talk a little bit about some of the courses that we do have, one of which is coming up, and it's the Depth Hypnosis Foundation course. And depth hypnosis is a spiritual counseling model that I developed specifically for bodhisattvas. And it's a place that brings It's a model that brings together Buddhist psychology, shamanic practices for healing, energy medicine, hypnotherapy, and transpersonal psychology. And it really does provide you, taking it as a student to understand your own experience and your own relationship to your own pain, and then taking it as a student to understand what is suffering and how does one. What is my relationship to suffering, and how can I best work with that understanding of relationship to suffering to help other people? I mean, this is where the pedal hits the metal for the Bodhisattva in this class. You have very practical tools for helping people get to the bottom of the trauma that is at the root of many symptoms and responses that people are dealing with in the world. That's coming up, and there's a discount for the class. There's a link in the chat, I understand, if you sign up for it within the next few days. And also, if you would like to follow our classes and at the Sacred Stream, you can go to sacredstream.org and sign up for our newsletter, and you get a free meditation download for doing that. If you want to try another class, a little bit smaller class than the Depth Hypnosis Foundation course, we do have the Dreams class and the Fundamentals of Integrated Energy Medicine class coming up next weekend. So we have a lot of things happening at Sacred Stream, and it's so nice to be, as an organization, to be a sort of a sister organization. I see it as a sister organization to Sangha Live, because I feel like we are, in our own way, doing our best to bring as much enlightened activity to the world. And it's, in order to teach, you have to have students. So I think, being on the path with all of you, having the opportunity to connect with you in whatever way we connect, and it's such a wonderful opportunity that we have to be together and to unite our ways of working in the world, knowing there are so many. I'm sure that all of you are engaged in so much enlightened activity that is helping the world, especially during these times. Having a global community like Sangha Live is so important to support all of you, all of us that are working to provide a counter force to some of the forces of unconsciousness that seem to be predominating these days. I just want to send appreciation to all of you for all of the enlightened activity that you engage in as well. I'd like to go ahead and take any questions that you have coming out of my very brief talk. Some of you, I think some of you do know me already, and you know that I can go on, especially about this subject. It's very hard to shut me up about this subject, but I'm proud of myself. I kept myself almost to the time limit. I'd be happy to answer any questions and expand on any ideas that you might request for the next little bit.
So here's Liz. Liz has got a question.
Thank you.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you for talking about the Bodhisattva vow. I'm 86 years old, and I took the Bodhisattva vow at least 25 years ago. And in the last 3 or 4 years, I don't know why or how, my trauma. I've seen my trauma experience, how it's penetrated my life and still influences my life. And a lot of it has lifted. But when I took that vow 25 years ago, I didn't have some of the wisdom and insight that I have now. So I just want to say, for me, it's so important to see this as a path of development. It's a lifetime path, and it's a commitment. And I'm very, very grateful that I've been on the path and still have miles to go before and after I sleep. But thank you for talking about it. My teachers, I'm a Vipassana practitioner, and Our teachers never talk about the Bodhisattva vow, and sometimes they ask me to say it, and I love the Bodhisattva vow. I'm so grateful to it, and I learned it at Pema Chodron's monastery 25 years ago. That's where I first took it, and I'm grateful. Thank you for talking about it and presenting it. And it is a commitment and a lifetime's journey.
Thank you.
We've got Sefa on the screen with a question.
Yes. Thank you, Issa. Yeah, I don't know how to frame this question. I feel like I took the vow also maybe 20 years ago. And only recently have I come to the realization that, I don't know how to talk about this, that self-sacrifice is almost like a false bodhisattva vow. And there's a line in a Woody Allen film where he says, if someone somewhere in the world is suffering, it ruins my whole day. But that's sort of the way I took the Bodhisattva vow. I can't relax. I can't find joy or feel joy unless everyone in the world is okay. And so my relationship with the vow this year has shifted. It feels like I love the way you describe your proper relationship to suffering. I'm going to really dwell with that phrase, because I don't think the vow asks us to suffer until the suffering of the world ends, but I'm kind of in relationship with that question.
I can offer you a thought if you want me to try
Yes,
to.
please.
Yeah. So, that idea of self-sacrifice, of course, is a huge issue when bringing the idea of the Bodhisattva and being on the path of service to Westerners, because we do have this hero of, even though we're, many of us are secular, we do have this hero of Jesus Christ as a martyr to other people's suffering. And it's and we're encouraged in many different ways, to put others first. This is that it's selfish to try to have something that other people don't have, like happiness. And I think that this is a huge, permeating, I think, misunderstanding about the nature of service and what it means to be a bodhisattva. Because what you're trying to do as a bodhisattva, as in training, is you are trying to get to the place where you can generate the field of bodhicitta. Bodhicitta is the essence of the altruistic impulse. And bodhicitta is filled with loving kindness. It's filled with compassion. It's filled with joy. It's filled with equanimity. And it is a field of rejoicing, actually, in the Dharma, in the teachings, in the possibility of the state of enlightenment, in this possibility that others can be free, that we can be free. There's this very expanded idea of what it is to be an agent of healing, to be an agent of making things better. And in order to do that, you have to be full yourself. And it's very difficult for a hungry man to share their bread with another hungry man. It's very easy for a person who has plenty to eat to give bread to a hungry man. And so the idea that you could serve from a place of fullness is something that I think everyone needs to consider. And in Buddhism, even the pursuit of material wealth in at least the Mahayana schools, it's not considered to be something like taboo or negative the way that it is in some other schools, and also and certainly in Christianity, you know, where poverty brings you closer to God. Where, you know, the idea that you could attain even material wealth, not just spiritual wealth, but you would attain that, you would allow yourself to have that so that you can give it away, so that you can share it. But you can't, if you cannot bring the spirit of enlightenment to others, if you cannot bring it to yourself, if you cannot truly bathe in all of the beauty of the spirit of enlightenment, and allow all of the places within you that have been separated from that spirit of enlightenment to drink from the well of bodhicitta, so that you can fill yourself and know that you can be a field, an enlightenment field, that you can yourself hold down an enlightenment field, or be a tent stake in the enlightenment field, so that you can bring this idea into the world and hold it in the world. And this is what I was talking about before. Especially these days, we need to be a strong and powerful current against the forces of enlightenment. And we don't do that by things I used to do in my youth, all of the warrior lifetimes I've spent in my incarnations. You know, we do that. I mean, give me a chance and I will do that any moment. But the idea is to fill oneself and one's experience and all of the places of darkness and fear we have within us, with the understandings that emerge from our practice in trying to attain the skillful means and the wisdom to relieve our own suffering and the suffering of others. And so that vision of the swan moving into samsara, like the swan is beautiful, it's graceful, it's powerful, it can move with grace. That is the state that we try to, at least I try to attain in helping others, so that it isn't a struggle, that we aren't martyred, that we aren't somehow locked in poverty and through our vow. We are a poverty of spirit or material wealth or any other kind of poverty. We are offering our altruistic intention from this place of rejoicing. And I know this is a Mahayana idea. This is very Mahayana, and it's interesting for me to hear, Liz, who's talking about, the Vipassana teachers don't talk about this. Yeah, I mean, I spent a lot of years in a zendo, so I know all about that. But I really think that we can rejoice with altruistic intention, and that altruistic intention can inform our rejoicing as we help other people.
Charles was next. Can just unmute yourself, Charles. There's a little, should be a microphone at the bottom of your screen.
Here I go.
There.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, thank you. I love your swan image, and you certainly evoke swanness so much yourself as soon as I saw you, Sohamsa. So recently I read something which was of great interest to me. That there is the samsara, the world of samsara that we live in, of enlightenment and samsara, the good and the bad, So we have wonderful things, and then that, because we have wonderful things, we have horrible things. On that idea. And but recently, I was given the idea that there's also this other energy, which does not have this duality to it. And so can you talk about that?
Sure. Yes, this idea, you know, that, you know, you have to have unhappiness in order to have happiness, you know, like I know this idea, this philosophy. And you're right, it is dualistic in nature. And again, I didn't have as much time as I would have liked, because I was trying to rush through my remarks to make sure we had, that I was within the parameters of Sangha Live's class timing. But the attainment of nirvana, or the attainment of the enlightened state, is not something from a Mahayana point of view or Vajrayana point of view, but Mahayana point of view. It's not something, attaining nirvana or attaining enlightenment is not something that is separate from samsara, actually, ultimately. Because not only have you spent quite a bit of time in samsara learning about the nature of what separates you from nirvana, and thereby learning about nirvana or the enlightened state, that's a huge learning right there. And so they're not separate there. But also there are practices, particularly within the Dzogchen schools of practice, where the idea is to, within the realm of samsara, in the presence of any samsaric vision or experience, is to be able to perceive the enlightenment spirit, or the ground luminosity, that is at the heart of whatever manifestation of illusion or negativity or suffering lies before you. Is, and the practice is to be able to hold, I mean, you have to work to practice to be able to hold the non-dual state separate from this part of the practice. I mean, you have to work toward understanding. And again, you know, you get a lot of Buddhist teachings, you know, you're not supposed to work, and then you get other teachings, you're supposed to work really hard. You need to move toward an understanding of the non-dual state itself, which is attained, you know, this is the basis of many different, you know, this is why you have so many schools in Buddhism, because everybody's got a different idea about how you get there, right? But you can even begin just with shamatha meditation, and just allow the focus on the breath to help you drop all considerations of anything other than the breath, and then that space that opens up as you focus on the breath, and then just rest there. And this is a Zen idea, and there are, you know, within Dzogchen there are many, many paths to understanding this non-dual state. And then the next part of the practice is to, once you have this understanding of the non-dual state, is to be able to perceive the truth of the two truths teachings, which I'll talk about in just a minute. But to see, again, the ground luminosity with at the heart of any manifestation. And this is something that can be pursued in terms of understanding through the teachings of the two truths. And in the two truths, you have the ultimate truth and you have the relative truth. And The relative truth is the truth of experience that we have here in this world of duality, here in samsara, where we are here meeting. I'm putting it in quotes because from a Dzogchen Bodhisattva point of view, this is also nirvana. But for discussion's sake, this is samsara. And and it is a relative reality where everything is related to one another. Everything is moving in relationship to one another. And then there is the ultimate truth, the place that is changeless, light-filled, compassion, blissful, that enlightened state where which is unchanging, right? And it's really important when even though we're saying it's two truths, it's really important. And I've seen a mistake that I think is a mistake of some teachers that will posit the relative truth against the ultimate truth. And I think it's really important to see that the teachings that are clear, His Holiness's teachings are clear on this, that they are part of the same thing, that the ultimate truth of experience is not more true than the relative truth of experience, and the relative truth of experience is not more true than the ultimate truth of experience, and that they both complement one another. As I said, you know, we've spent a lot of time here in samsara trying to understand the nature of suffering and how to liberate ourselves from it, and the holding of awareness and aspiration toward understanding ultimate truth is part of what has brought us through that. They are very connected. So, and there is much that we have in terms of understanding that comes out of the dualistic experience on the relative level that reveals, as I mentioned before, where we've gotten separated on the ultimate level. That's very informative. And that deepens our understanding of the ultimate truth. So, again, that's a little bit of an expanded teaching, but it can all be contracted down into one aspiration, which is to, on a daily basis, practice, do your shamatha meditation, letting that light-filled space open up within you, and then practice walking around in the world, trying to perceive the ground luminosity, which is the essence of the ultimate truth, in the heart of everything before you. And see if that doesn't dissolve this sense of dualistic separation that we started the conversation with.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, I think, we've got 10 more minutes and two more questions. So Fatin next, and then Sarah.
Hello, Isa.
Marhaba.
Marhaba. So good to be with you in this space again, live in real time. I am calling from, attending from Amman, Jordan now. And it's been 5 years that I've taken this oath, and I've taken it in a class actually with you, the Bodhisattva oath. And I remember at the time I took it, I was like, it's impossible. You know, like, this is such an impossible oath. It's so heavy. How can anyone take this kind of oath? And since 5 years, I relate to it very, very different right now. I really want to thank you for the way you answered the last two questions, specifically the one before this one, the last one. Actually, this one is also relative. Working with my clients in the Middle East and a lot of Palestinians who are coming in sessions carrying a lot of survival guilt. So even the people who are outside Palestine and they still have families inside Palestine, they're having a lot of difficulty, even if they're serving them. They have a lot of difficulty serving from a place that they can't allow themselves to feel joy or anything like this. So the way you spoke of it, and I feel that this has served me a lot in these sessions, talking about, you know, being full, the way you spoke of it, in order to give from that place. And I even recommend to them to go to Sacred Stream, find the class that's called the Path of Service so that they can take it, but it is not on demand. So I just wanted to share that. And I think that survival guilt might be so complex and has many layers to it, many reasons to it. But one of the ways, I think this is one of the aspects of it, is the misunderstanding about how to be in service. And I really appreciate that. And I guess it's interesting because I think that there are many people who are serving who have not taken that oath in different ways of serving. And it's just very difficult under the circumstances to see how to work with someone where there is such negativity on the other side. And knowing that the people who hold the negativity as well, or bringing the negativity themselves, are suffering as well. And how to approach this is very challenging. How to serve that. So I guess there is an answer there somewhere. I can't put my hand on it quite well, but yeah, how do you stay in sessions when you are not, when you're waiting for this light or for the answer to come from within the person themselves? How do you hold it as a person who is in service?
How do you hold their, for instance, their survival guilt? Is that what you're speaking about specifically?
Yeah, how do you hold it? How do you hold it when there's such conflict? How do you hold it? I find myself sometimes going into some teaching, and sometimes I'm not sure whether or not that's appropriate even. Yeah.
And we're talking about survival guilt, right, particularly?
We are talking about survival guilt, and also about the big question of, when there is such negativity, when there is such conflict, how do you navigate that? Knowing that people on the other side who are maybe involved in the negativity are also suffering, but they're not suffering in the same way, right? They're suffering in a way that's making other people suffer as well. So that's the question.
Okay, so to answer the second part of that question, it's what I was talking about before, the importance of becoming what Bob Thurman calls a Buddhaverse. Mm-hmm. The importance of doing everything that you can to clear your own karmic traces, to gain the wisdom that you can, to understand what it is to bring skillful means to the relief of suffering, and to hold with unshakable faith in the possibility of liberation and enlightenment for all, no matter what's manifesting, to hold that field, to not be brought down by any kind of comparison to negativity or anything else. That it's like you are holding this other way of being, and that you are doing it in this unapologetic way that is filled with joy, that is filled with love, that is filled with loving kindness, because that acts as a counterpoint to any of this horrible negativity that is going on in the world. And it keeps that negativity from taking over the world. The more of us that can hold this vision of the Buddhaverse, of filled with compassion, loving kindness, equanimity, joy, generosity, the more that we can hold that and do whatever we need to do to address our own suffering and our difficulty in holding that, the more that is going to help the world. And also remembering two things, and both this has to do with the people who are creating negativity, that they are, they to have compassion for them, because what they are creating for themselves is beyond any imaginable suffering that they are creating for others, to have mm-hmm. compassion for them. And then mm-hmm. in terms of people who have who have survivor's guilt. It's to help them understand what this is part of their karmic path, to remember that this is a karmic lesson that they are learning. This is something that is native to their path that is coming forward. And you have to figure out what it is within them. And this is with insight inquiry. You find out what it is within them is that is constellating them around the survivor's guilt. And there's something within them that's withholding, something within them that's constricting. There's something within them that needs to be liberated. And you can work with them on that level and help them. And it's quite unique to each person.
Okay. Thank you. And do we have the class offered? Can I have direct people to take that class with Sacred Stream, the Path of Service?
The Path of Service is coming up in May. So yeah, and I don't offer that on demand just because it's such a big class and I don't want to have people swimming in it on their own. I feel like, you know, I'm a little bit like a helicopter teacher, you know, like I want to be there making sure
that they... Thank you for letting me know. Thank you. Thank you.
But if you go to sacredstream.org, you'll find the Path of Service coming up in May. You can register for it.
Okay, we've got 2 minutes left. We do need to end as close to schedule as possible. So
okay.
Sarah, I think you're next.
Talk fast.
Keep it short. Yeah.
Talk fast and I'll talk fast.
Go ahead, Sarah.
Okay. Yes, Bodhisattva vows, but in all the energies that are happening, I think of you often. I think, how does Isa set boundary in a good way so that she's not energetically derailed by something coming in asking for support, like another being? It could be, you know, like different things have been happening where I've been requested in a more mediumship way, and I'm like, wait a minute. I want to be of service, and I want to tune my own energy system up in a real high vibration, and I don't want to be derailed that way. You know, I want to do what's mine to do. So it's a discerning question.
I think at this time, in terms of discernment, I think at this time, probably your task is to cultivate that field, the Buddha-verse field, and not engage with mediumship that would take you outside of it.
Okay. Thank you. Blessings.
Thank you, everyone. We're going to go ahead and close circle now. Again, you can repeat after me. Thank you again, Faith and Jorge. Thank you so much. And thank you all for being here. Let's close circle. The sun is a circle.
The sun is a circle.
The moon is a circle.
The moon is a circle.
The earth is a circle.
The earth is a circle.
The drum is a circle.
The drum is a circle.
We are a circle within a circle.
We are a circle within a circle.
And the power of this circle remains a non-ordinary reality. You can call upon it at any time.